Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, Sangha discussion on dependent origination, and Dhamma talk that introduces the ninth week study of the five clinging aggregates. This was recorded on February 11th, 2017, at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So last week your homework was to read the first part of chapter 8, week 8, on dependent origination. So I'd like to hear if you... Dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to, which states that consciousness that's rooted in ignorance can only develop suffering, dukkha, and so how that relates to the Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha awakened to that understanding, and then he taught Four Noble Truths so that we could recognize the problem, recognize our own individual contributions to the problem, and also develop the path that is the solution to the problem of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. So we'll start with Laura. Good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. what to say? As far as dependent origination goes, it just to me is kind of more an additional framework to look at what is occurring in life through. So again, I'm always, you know, the Four Noble Truths are like my, you know, they're always with me, so when I feel like I've lost some sense of consciousness or attention, they're like this reminder, and so if I find that I'm stuck or something feels like it's not kind of moving along the way I'd like it to move, if I want to dig deeper, I often will just kind of go through that by looking at dependent origination and the different components to it, and how to break it down if I feel confused, or if I want to have a little bit of a deeper understanding of what entanglements I'm involved in a given problem, situation, relationship, you know, whatever it may be. Dependent origination feels like a really, really meaty to me. Like really, really like this deeper work to do on the Eightfold Path within your practice. So, yeah, that's kind of what I don't know if that's confusing or
no.
Not correct, but...
It's absolutely correct. In fact, that's an important perception. The dependent origination can be overemphasized in importance and almost seen as a standalone path or a practice, but it was only taught as the originator of suffering. It's the Eightfold Path and the framework of the Eightfold Path that we develop that understanding. So to see it more as an aspect of the entire Eightfold Path is really putting it in its proper light. One of the problems with dependent origination and all the adaptations made to it over the years is because of placing too much importance of it almost as a standalone path, rather than really just to show what the Buddha awakened to. And if you look at the links in the chain, then you can see how to undo the chain. But the Eightfold Path develops that practice in the same way. So very good perception. Glad you're here this morning.
Good to be here.
Kevin, good morning. How are you? It's good to see you.
So I haven't been following it exactly with the course, but in my reading, I'm touching on that too. And really, you know, again, to reiterate, just trying to keep in mind the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And it is, I think, true that the dependent origination is the origin. trying to keep down the hindrances while trying to concentrate on that too.
Yeah.
I've had, this week I had a lot of, I had a very distracted mind. And as I'm meditating, I can see the five hindrances really coming up as I understand. But trying to keep coming back to my breathing. But today it was much better. It's great to be back in Sangha, so I can, I guess, feel the energy of everyone else here, be able to concentrate on. So it's not exactly an answer to your question, but that's where I am.
That's it's good enough. The importance of the Sangha is just that. It's so important, and we gain such great support. Kevin comes regularly to the Thursday night class in Clinton, Kevin and his wife Robin. So those of you that don't know Kevin, that's Kevin. There's everyone else. So it's nice to have you. I think this is your second time here on Saturday?
Yes. Yeah. So we missed on Thursday because of the snow, so I thought I have to have some Dhamma teaching. I better get back.
Yeah. I'm glad you're here. Yeah. I wouldn't say that you missed the class because of the snow. You missed the class because of my unwillingness to drive in 2 inches of snow. So. I'm glad you're here. Lisa, good morning. It's good to see you.
Good morning, John. Nice to see you, too. I read the introduction about the not-self, and only a couple pages into dependent origination, because I was really trying to understand it and think about it. And in some ways, I feel overwhelmed by like the seeming complication of it all. And in other ways, I think about it as being like the ultimate simplicity.
Yeah.
And just for a couple of the things that I read, a lot of the book is repetition and saying things in a lot of different ways. I think maybe the Buddha understood that, people are going to learn things and everyone's going to take their own path to wherever it is they're going. And they're all going to be unique and different. And so he said things in a lot of different ways, because people learn things in different ways. And things will resonate, there's a lot of repetition about Buddha said, basically said, I teach, the fact of dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, or the origination. I forget exactly how it was, but that's repeated in a lot of different ways, and I don't know whether I'll ever really understand how it all gets put together, but it may not matter, really.
It doesn't matter.
It's just a feeling, but this whole impermanence thing, people want things, I and a lot of people, rock solid.
Yeah.
In our culture is that, he's rock solid, the Rock of Gibraltar, it's written in stone, all these things that are, we think are, the idea of permanent, and of course they're not.
Yeah.
And it's scary. People, you want something solid, you want something visual, and like experiencing things with the five senses, which give you the illusion that that is what they are. But it's really the sixth sense, which I think is the mind and consciousness.
Yep.
And that's the scary part. It's very hard to let go and say, okay, things are going to be impermanent. But I think the repetition, I went back and I read. So instead of reading on what I was supposed to read, I went back and I thought, well, now it's been quite a number of weeks. I'm going to go back and reread. And, doing that, it's like reading a whole different thing.
Yeah. Because now you have the proper perspective and context in which to see it.
Yeah, somehow it's seeping in.
Yeah.
it just seeps in, and you don't really know it. I mean, I have felt generally that I don't react, and I'm not as, you know, react as crazy as I usually do, or overreact, and things just seem like it's just I'm more accepting.
Yeah.
I don't know, just this, but you know, it's hard to pin down because it's in my mind.
Yep.
And I can't just say, here it is, you know. It's just a feeling.
Like foam on the ocean is how the Buddha referred to it. Our views, you know. You really are speaking about the essence of what the Buddha taught, and to recognize the impermanence of all things. And he understood that dukkha arises, meaning all levels of stress, from mild disappointment to extreme emotional and physical suffering, arises from the need to hold on to things, make things permanent, when nothing is permanent, nothing. And it can't be. It's the environment that we live in. We can't change it no matter how much we'd like to. And then the subtle problem is trying to establish a permanent self in this always impermanent environment. It can't be done. And that creates the stress and distraction of dukkha. You said something that's very profound. Dependent origination is both, I can't remember the exact words you used, but it's very complicated and it's also very simple. And it is, depending on the perspective that you're looking at it from. When we understand the nature of suffering, you look at dependent origination, so yeah, there it is. It's a complete explanation of how it happens. But you talked about how the Buddha used different teachings, but always teaching to the same subject. What he understood when he was in front of an individual or a group of people was the conditioned mind that he was talking to. And so he presented the same teaching in different contexts to get past that conditioned thinking. Everything the Buddha taught for 45 years was in the context of the Four Noble Truths. But he said the same thing in many different ways. So dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to. He didn't teach dependent origination in any form. It's called the Paticca-samuppada. He didn't teach that until much later in his teaching career. The first thing he taught was the Four Noble Truths. So he was laying the foundation for everything else that he would teach. But he had to teach that first. And if you look at the way the book is laid out, it's laid out kind of in the same way. In other words, if I started with dependent origination, I think people would have read half the chapter, taken the book, and thrown it in the garbage. Because there's no context for understanding it. And Lorna almost did it twice even the way... And even in its position in the book and its position in the Dhamma, many people struggle with dependent origination, but it's only because of our own conditioned mind. We just don't want to see things in that simple way until we have the proper context. And so you're developing it beautifully. And the reason I know that is because you're describing it in the proper context. So thank you very much.
I have to be very accepting of not understanding what I'm reading.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or having a mental block against reading it because of the, you know, of that whole notion of, you know, permanence.
Yeah.
It also occurs to me, I don't know why, but maybe Buddha was the first, like, 12-step addiction counselor.
He certainly, I mean, because everything he teaches also speaks to addictions.
The other word in there was compulsion. That was in that. And I thought compulsion, addiction, because we are addicted to, you know, being miserable, you know, and permanence and all these things that cause dukkha. And so I think there's 12 something or others, maybe it's dependent origination or something, but I just thought, oh, it's a 12-step program.
There's an amazing similarity between what the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous address and develop a solution to. The Buddha identified the three marks of existence, which we'll talk about in 2 weeks, of impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and resulting suffering. The not-self characteristic refers to self-referential views that we get locked into that create suffering. The 12 steps are designed, in fact, it says in the book that it's based on, that self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. And then the 12 steps is really an exploration of how that manifests in an addict's life. Well, whether we're addicts or not, we're addicted to self-referential views. And the solution is very, very similar. There's such an amazing similarity between what the 12 steps develop and their focus and what the Eightfold Path develops. And that's one of the reasons why I started mindfulness-based recovery, because there's many people in the world today that just object to the modern application or the modern presentation in AA and NA and the other 12-step programs. And this is an alternative that's just as effective because it gets to the it addresses the same problem, which is self-centeredness. You know, it really is remarkable. So yeah, the craving and clinging that's addressed or taught as the second noble truth is what an addict or an alcoholic experiences, or any compulsive experiences, every moment of their life. They can't get past that craving and clinging to whatever brings relief, even if it's a destructive type of relief. Well, it's much more immediate and obvious to someone who's stuck in compulsion, but it's a common human problem. You know, many people have much more subtler levels of it and less devastating, but the end result is that we live a life of distraction, chasing what gives us pleasure and avoiding what we hope to avoid. Can't be done. So thank you. Very, very insightful. Good to see you, Andrew. How are you this morning?
Now, after hearing about your teachings about dependence origination and reading about it, I'm still not grasping the concept. And Lisa just mentioned that it's the ultimate simplicity, but it's that simplicity that's evaded me.
Yeah.
The modifier dependent, I think I can understand, but the origination part of it, is that the self-referential view one has, or something other?
Dependent origination states that from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises, meaning suffering arises because of a very specific ignorance. And that ignorance is ignorance of Four Noble Truths, which is the true nature of life in the true nature of human life. There is going to be dukkha. In other words, the saying is dukkha occurs. There's going to be disappointment, unsatisfactory experiences. There's going to be suffering simply by having a human life. That almost seems too simplistic until we realize that we as human beings, we become conditioned to run away or chase anything that gives us pleasure and to run away from anything that might give us displeasure. And that creates a constant discursive and distractive way of looking at the world. Rather than developing a profound understanding that simply as a result of living in the world, there's going to be dukkha, there's going to be disappointment. So that ignorance then states, from ignorance, it states up there too, from ignorance as a requisite or a dependent condition, come mental fabrications. That's the next link in the 12 link. Mental fabrications, the simplest word to put on that is assumptions. We create assumptions based on an ignorant view of who we are in relation to the world. And if you can understand that one point, then you can see that anything that flows from that is going to be rooted in ignorance and will cause confusion, delusion, and suffering. And you can really stop there and not be too concerned about the rest of the 12 links, just understand that one part. That it's just from a view that is lacking an understanding of what's really occurring. So how do we develop that right view, which is the first factor of the Eightfold Path? It is through the Eightfold Path that we gain the ability to see things clearly. So like we've talked about already, it's not so important to fully grasp what dependent origination says, even though it is very simple. Just to understand that it points to the problem and it points to the solution. It points to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Many people can get hung up on, I just can't get dependent origination, and they'll use that almost as an excuse to say, well, this is all nonsense. It's just difficult for me. It was difficult for me to really grasp it at first. But a lot of my problem with it was that I already had a conditioned view based on the later developed teachings of what dependent origination states, which has nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. It. You want to see something really complicated, look at the modern applications of dependent origination or dependent co-arising. It's often presented as this grand, elaborate creation myth that ends up with that we are all interconnected in one great cosmic being, and it just doesn't say that. You know, all that might be true, but that just complicates dependent origination even further. So what I'm saying, Andrew, is don't be too concerned that you're not grasping it right now. It's enough to understand that it points to the Four Noble Truths as the path of liberation and freedom.
Could you spice it to say that the dependent origination is really the ignorance? It doesn't mean the same thing as ignorance of the Four Noble Truths.
It does state that. It does state that it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to suffering. And then the Buddha breaks down in 12 links how that happens. And the reason why the links are important is that you, if you really want to get into it, you can look at any one of the links, such as craving. If I can recognize craving and abandon craving, I've broken that link and the whole causative chain falls apart. So you don't have to fully develop a profound understanding of each and every link in the chain, just to understand that that the chain causes suffering, and the path to the cessation of suffering is the Eightfold Path. Kind of like what Laura said, you know, it's a conceptual aspect of the Eightfold Path, but it's not a path in and of itself. Does that help, or is that a disappointing answer? Yeah, and like again, like we've talked about, it takes a few times through to really understand how it's applied. Mm-hmm. So even going through the book a few times, you'll gain a greater understanding of dependent origination as you develop the Eightfold Path and as you come back and look at it. Isn't that right, Lorna?
If you pick it up, you just...
Yeah.
I think it's when you like develop that quietness and time that you can, at your own will and fruition, decide to take dependent origination and take those steps that are laid out and kind of try to have a self-observation of these things and kind of come to your own understanding and conclusion about it.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not something that, I mean, and it's all impermanent. So once you have your leading observation and you're like, yeah, that's it, then it literally just goes out the window. So you can't, even within dependent origination, you still have to respect the whole Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. You know, so you can't hold on to it. It's really just, I feel like in a quiet place, you can kind of have that observation and get a deeper understanding of your own process, whatever that is, and that must be very individual.
Yeah, and that's what it's describing. It's describing the individual process that from ignorance we create suffering in our lives. That's really all it states. I think one of the reasons why this simple direct teaching has over the years become very, very complicated is because of common human conditioned thinking to see things in their simple way, especially this. So this has been adapted to a modern application that has no resemblance to this simple teaching because of conditioned thinking. It's probably the single most misunderstood teaching of the Buddha, and once you understand it, it is probably the most simple and direct. But again, you have to have the proper context. If your context for applying dependent origination is itself rooted in ignorance, meaning a different context, then it has to have a different application and a different development. And in fact, I mean, if you want to do something interesting, go do a web search on dependent origination or dependent co-arising and see what's presented then as that. And you'll see that it has no resemblance to this. And some of it is really, really way out there. But that's, you know, that's okay. I'm not putting those down, except it's just not what the Buddha taught. So, and just to say it again, it takes it takes a complete understanding of the purpose of the Buddhist teachings and the framework in order to understand it. If you just looked at dependent origination and had nothing else to look at, it's like, why even bother with this? You know, there's no even useful application when you look at it as a standalone teaching. But it's simply something that is presented in the context of the Eightfold Path. It's a great question. A lot of people struggle with it, at least at first. But, you know, eventually you get it. Eventually you get it. And you see how simple it is. And it just describes the nature of suffering arises. Which is, you know, it's also interesting, Lisa said too, that the Buddha stated over and over again during his teaching, because it kept coming up, I teach suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. That's what dependent origination is. The reason why he keeps saying that is that's exactly what he awakened to. He set out 6 years prior to understand suffering. And he eventually came to the understanding of suffering and a way to bring it to cessation, at least our own individual contributions to suffering. So, glad you're here. Please say hello to Judy for me. Becky, good morning. It's good to see you.
Nice to be here. Well, I feel like I'm still just barely internalizing the Four Noble Truths. So dependent origination is like out there somewhere. I read it. I didn't understand any of it. And I'll read it again, and I'll come back and go through this class again and take. And eventually, I'm sure, as with Lisa, it will seep in.
Yeah. It will. Thank you. And that's just how it works. And it's also, even though we're looking at it in context of the book and really in the context of the Four Noble Truths, it's still difficult. When last year's retreat was remarkable in how it developed, but also once we got to that, to dependent origination, which I think was first introduced Saturday afternoon, as a group, as a retreat, we were looking at it in that rather refined context of a retreat. In other words, we went at it in a methodical way like we're doing here, but in a tighter context. And it was, I think it's much easier to understand that way, just simply because our minds are inclined towards it, and also a retreat setting where we're really just focused on the Dhamma helps.
But I also think that you, like Laura said, I think you have to work sort of, you have to just keep doing what you're doing and having the success that you're having.
Yep.
And get there on your own.
Yeah.
I don't think intellectually understanding it is, I don't even know if you can understand it intellectually. That it's just, it's getting there, and then it's like, oh, is that what other people think? Or, because what I'm going through with this whole practice is I'm just starting to realize what a conditioned mind is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And every once in a while when I'm meditating, I'll have a breakthrough, like, oh my God, you know, I'm doing this. This is me. I don't have to do this to myself.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's profound. I mean, it will, like, I'll just, like, sort of burst into tears, you know, all by myself. But I feel like those kinds of things, that is what will continue to happen. And sometimes when I'm meditating, I feel like I'm even getting a little bit of a deeper understanding of what my mind is doing. And but I don't, I think that I just have to keep working at that.
Yep.
To get to the point where I can use dependent origination as Laura described it.
Yes.
She's aware of it, and she can think of it, and she can go to it when she's feeling that she needs a deeper understanding of something.
Yeah. And Laura's been at it for a while. I mean, you were at last year's retreat.
What I mean.
And
you have to be at it for a while.
Retreat.
Yeah, you have to. But what you're describing, though, that understanding your mind is exactly what we're trying to do. And that comes from having developed a framework and the context in which to actually look at your mind.
Yes.
You need that. Without that proper framework, it's conditioned mind looking at conditioned mind. It's just going to keep creating conditions. Another word for that is ignorance, ongoing ignorance. You need a proper framework. And that's the sole reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. He recognized a common human problem of conditioned thinking, and he thought seriously, what can I do? How can I teach what I know to get past common conditioned thinking? And that's the framework of the Eightfold Path. You have to be able to recognize it. You have to know what you're looking at, and that's just what you said. Mm-hmm. For the first time, you realize that you're looking at your own mind. You have to have that signpost. You know, you have to know where you are. You hear me say this often. If you're in New York and you want to get to Chicago, but you think you're in Los Angeles, you can't get there. If you want to understand the quality of your mind, you have to be there. You have to have a way of actually looking at it in the proper context. And then you can develop real wisdom and end that ignorance of Four Noble Truths. In other words, you can gain wisdom of the nature of suffering. When the Buddha described fully awakened, fully developed right view, he says right view understands at a profound level suffering. Right view is a view that has developed from abandoning, craving, and clinging. Right view has developed from experiencing the cessation of suffering. Right view has developed directly through the Eightfold Path. That's how the Buddha described an awakened right view, and that's what we're doing. It's the Eightfold Path that provides the framework and context for understanding all of this. And like Laura pointed out, dependent origination is just one concept within that larger framework. You know? And again, it's not something that, from what I can find, the Buddha gave, it said 84,000 different teachings. That's just a number that represents a lot. We don't know how many, but so we use that number. But I've read a lot of the Pali Canon. I would say probably 80, maybe 85% of it. And I've only come to two suttas where the Buddha teaches dependent origination. So it was important in the proper context, but it wasn't something that he taught as doctrine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more of an explanation, that's all. So again, we can overemphasize the importance of dependent origination. In one way you could look at it is it's the most important thing the Buddha ever taught, but you can't even take that out of context. He didn't teach this as the path. He taught an eightfold path. So, great discussion so far. Thank you. Jen, good to see you this morning. How are you?
I've enjoyed whatever you said so far. I might sit back here more often. Started to understand it was just how conditioned mind originates, how it comes to being, and that depends on your conditioned mind. So I'm fascinated with dependent origination, and I'm just going to eye make for a second because I consider myself an intellectual and I love analyzing the human mind. And I think it's remarkable that a human being sat under a tree and figured out the human mind just by sitting. I think what the Buddha was explaining when he explained dependent origination was this is how your mind works. This is the nature of your mind. Yep. And it has this propensity to condition itself in order to, well, whatever the reason. I mean, if you want to get into a philosophical conversation about how it somehow ultimately protects you from something in the world, whatever. It's where we are, this is how our minds are, and they condition they tend to create these circles of protection, and they're all, sometimes they're helpful, most of them are nonsense.
Yeah.
And I mean, I went on the retreat and I started to really understand the 12 causative links, which are the circle of conditioning. You get into this circle, this ring of conditioned thinking, and it just continues to perpetuate itself until you concentrate on the Four Noble Truths. That's my understanding of it.
That's beautiful. The one thing I would correct is it wasn't just sitting that got the Buddha to his understanding. What he did prior to that is just as significant. In fact, it led to him understanding what practices would work and which wouldn't, because he tried. He studied with the foremost so-called spiritual teachers of his time. Their teachings were different applications, but rooted in the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism. He studied studied and learned the most advanced, so-called advanced meditation techniques, and he rejected all of that as not leading to his goal of understanding the nature of suffering. He tried all types of different ascetic practices, denying himself even the basic human needs of food. It said that he lived on a grain of rice or one bean a day. He got so emaciated that it nearly killed him. And he tried a lot of other different practices too that were common at the time. None of them worked. And it was finally, out of all that frustration of trying all the things that didn't work, that he says, now I'm going to sit. And I'm going to sit here as long as it takes until I gain understanding. What that refers to is that right effort and right intention. And having that lifetime of experience of what did not bring him understanding allowed him to understand what would and what the problem was. For the previous 36 years, he finally recognized that everything I was doing was rooted in ignorance. It was everything that he was doing up until that time, and he speaks about this in a little bit of an obtuse way. I can't think of the sutta right now. He realized that everything he was doing, including the so-called advanced spiritual practices, was all just an exercise in continued eye-making. He was looking for a way to continue to establish a self in some kind of new idea or new paradigm. He rejected them all and said, there can't be any paradigm because a paradigm is permanent. Nothing is permanent. He saw the nature of his own impermanence. And that's what leads to the understanding of ignorance. You could say that each link in dependent origination is, every one of them is an impermanent link. And you could say that the Four Noble Truths describe impermanence when you really understand that. So thank you for what you said. Jay, good morning. It's good to see you today.
Thank you. Good to see you. Well, as we've gone around the room, I've changed my thoughts about what my comments might be.
Talk about impermanence.
That I'm not even sure where to hang my hat. But, that is my problem. I read the work and reread it, and I understand the importance, I think, of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and I pretty much know where I am in that situation in a couple of regards. When I retired 2 years ago, I've had to make the change, but between being a crane operator, a father, and so on, and being a retired person with time on my hands to think and do a study like this, and so the not self and all that, I'm hung up in that because I'm still trying to create a new identity, even though I know intellectually that an identity as a rock-solid object is a silly thing. But the other thing is, having read that, my hang-up is the clinging and craving. I'm clinging to stuff and I'm craving stuff, and I have not been able to initial instruction of listening to everyone in the class and the Sangha, it really helps. It definitely helps. And I think last time I indicated I was mainly confused with the work that we were supposed to study. I think at this point, I'm less confused about it, but just in a conundrum of, you know, well, I can't seem to break that chain in my mind between, you know, doing these things that are non-productive or an antithesis to having a good mind or a clear mind or whatever, you know. So I'm muddling along, but I think I know where the pitfalls that are affecting me most are.
Yeah. And that's so important, too. You know, again, first you have to have recognition of the problem, of your own contributions to the problem.
Yeah.
And then you can start setting the right direction. What you've just described is, I think everybody has felt that way and thought that way and often expressed it here. Craving and clinging is the problem. That's the second noble truth. You're not unique. None of us are unique in that. And even the recognition of the problem is certainly not enough to just say, most of us can't say, okay, I'm going to let go of all craving and clinging. There's a process of recognizing and renunciation. You know, recognizing what, and that, again, that's what the framework of the Eightfold Path is for. If it was just enough to say that's the problem, you know, that the Buddha would have stopped there. He says, oh, craving and clinging is a problem. Stop it. You know, the only one that I've ever come across was Kandana that could do it. You know, he got it right away. Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and the Buddha's attendant for the last 25 years of his life, didn't fully get it until a month after the Buddha passed. And he got it because he was a little upset too.
One thing that I've been meaning to ask you, and I have not, in almost every religion there's somebody held as an example as being somewhat of a fool, or somebody who doesn't get it, or a simpleton, or something like that. Is there such a character in all of this? You know, because sometimes I feel like that.
What a great question. And my, as you were asking the question, I was rushing ahead and saying, no, I haven't. But there are quite a few that the Buddha actually would use. These are Pali words, but they're translated into English words as foolish person or foolish man or foolish woman. A few that come to mind is the wanderer Vajragoda, who would come in and out of the Buddha's life. This is a guy that was wandering around northern India like a lot of seekers at the time. And he would get a sit down with the Buddha, and he would ask these very esoteric questions: where are we going, where are we from, blah 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 blah. And the Buddha would listen to him quietly, and then he'd say, Vajragoda, it's your questions that are confusing you. Let go of the questions. And Vajragoda would mumble and walk away, and he'd come back a few years later with the same questions. So there's an example of that. There's even more extreme examples of people that were so antagonistic to what the Buddha was teaching that they actually tried to kill the Buddha. You know, it didn't, never worked out. But it's important to understand. Andrew was talking a little bit about this too. It's one of the reasons why I say we need to be very gentle with ourselves if we're going to develop this, because it's too easy to fall into that common Western mindset that I just can't get it. Or it's too difficult, you know, I'm unique in the whole world, I'm the only one who can't get this simple Dhamma. It's true. But it's because of conditioned thinking that we feel that way. So that's really addressed right up front. Don't worry about your views. Don't be so concerned about your resistance to this, but right effort, that sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, shows us that it's just continued right effort that will bring the result. You know, unless we can prove to ourselves that we're not really a human being, then this stuff should work, because it's taught for human beings. There is no individual that's set up as a fool in the Buddha's Dhamma, but there are quite a few individuals that are used kind of as an example of how not to do it. But in the same way, there's not one individual that's set up as a superhuman being or a god, like most religions have. The Buddha never set himself up. When you understand, and there's a chapter at the end of the book, and we'll talk about this during this cycle, in the Ratana Sutta, that talks to the three refuges, the three jewels of the Dhamma, meaning the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The Buddha sets himself up as an example of a human being who awakened, and that's the only way he ever portrayed himself. He never set himself above human beings in any way or in any special way except to call himself the Tathagata, which simply means the one who did this first, the one who figured it out. That's the only difference that he said. And when he talks about awakened human beings using the term arahant, he refers to himself that same way, and the only specialness that he applies to his own arahantship, awakening, is that he's the one that figured it out. That's all. We all achieve that same thing by following this simple and direct path that any human being can get with a little effort. So, thank you. Lorna, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Read the chapter and concentrating on the 12 steps of dependence. I think that for me, why it's so hard to get it into my head is that you can't actually latch it onto something else that's familiar in life, that you can latch it onto and think about it and understand it that way.
Okay.
You just have to take blind faith that this is what happens. And I'm not sufficiently skilled yet to feel this process or observe this process in my mind. I'm not there yet. So I'm still just taking dependent origination on blind faith that this is what happens, rooted from not understanding the Four Noble Truths and not following the path of the Four Noble Truths. This is the 12 steps that your brain takes to get to dukkha. Always create dukkha and stress. So I understand the concept of it, but I don't feel it, or, well, that's all I can say about it, really. Anyway, and when I read it again, I didn't get any great insight as to anything that I've not realized before. But this week I've been thinking about conditioned thinking a lot, which is kind of like on the outskirts of dependent origination, but not actually. And also, it's kind of linked into dependent origination, but not the 12 steps. But I've been thinking about the just how I do, I call it my bidding to my conditioned mind. I mean, I do things, I see myself doing things from a conditioned mind. This is Lorna, this is what I do. And the many times I go around, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. Then I fall back in the conditioned thinking. I get on the principles, and it's all sort of churning around in my mind and following it, and trying to observe it, follow, you know, be in the right mind and things like that. But so that's where I am at the moment. But I just want to say that I've had some nice meditations this week, and that's all I have to say.
Thank you. You could almost say that the Eightfold Path is the instruction manual for developing an understanding of dependent origination. You know, you really need to have a pretty well understanding of that before you see how these simple teachings apply. You know, it's like if you I used this last Tuesday. If you wanted to learn how to change the oil in your car, but you read how to grow tulips, that instruction is not going to do you any good at all for changing the oil in the car. You have to have it in the proper context. So, again, dependent origination in and of itself is really meaningless. But when you start developing the Eightfold Path and understand how to apply it, how to, you know, the instruction manual, this is how you use it, then it makes some sense. But again, you can't overemphasize the importance of it, or you shouldn't overemphasize the importance of dependent origination, because it isn't a key teaching, it's a key understanding. It's probably a better way to put it. You know, so thank you. Mary, it's good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. When I read through dependent origination, understand how one leads to another, and then that's about it. And then it, poof, it's like gone. But I do, in my life, seeing me applying a lot of the things I've learned in this class in little ways, so I feel like there are little chinks in the armor being made.
Yeah.
And reading through the things over and over, it helps to root them a little more deeply in me so that they come about more automatically.
Yeah.
And, I mean, to try to change the conditioned thinking, I mean, to me that's just so key to gaining clarity, is to change that conditioned thinking. But boy, that's a tough nut to crack.
It is, but you're gaining ground, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, and that's so important to recognize that, and it just for our, to continue, that's an aspect of right effort, to see how this is really working. This is really effective. It's changing, for the better, my quality of life as my life unfolds, which is exactly why the Buddha taught it, for this human life, so we can develop awakening, full human maturity now. You know, this is the time to do it. The last words the Buddha said is, impermanence and decay is relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. Do it now. Have the experience now. Thank you for sharing that. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Honestly, I'm tired. So when Jay was saying that about craving and clinging, I just thought, yeah, you're human. And I thought, I'm really experiencing that. You know, just trying to be okay with being human. Knowing that I'm 66 years old and didn't start this until March last year, and so yeah, I got lots of conditioned thinking and lots of years of it, so I gotta really be gentle with myself. You know, like Mary said, sometimes I see little chinks of, you know, it comes up and I realize that it's helping me in little ways to make changes. And when I'm working as hard as I am right now, so I'm not having the opportunity to read and reread this material a lot, you know, and so I think I'd understand it better if that, you know, I did read it last weekend, and, you know, I mean, the first was kind of overwhelmed by the whole 12 steps. I work in addiction, so of course,
yeah.
You know, it's like I did that 12-step thing too. Oh, okay, it's all connected. I don't know. I think it's going to take a lot more reading, a lot more, integration. And I'm just trying to be kind to myself that, you know, so right now, I try to find the time here and there to, and when I come home after working huge long hours, I'm too tired to try to focus on this and take it in. So, you know, weekends I try to, you know, do this, do more reading. And I liked what Laura said about the, it's kind of the meat a little bit deeper. It's more, you know, I'm backing up and I'm just trying to focus on learning the Eightfold Path a lot. You know, that it's connected. I see the connection. In terms of ignorance, I see that, but I'm just trying to focus on having the time to really understand the Eightfold Path, and I can't wait to go back and reread that, you know, just when I have time to do that. Right now I'm just trying to wade through the book, but anyway, I don't mean to have excuses. I'm just trying to be kind to myself.
Yeah, thank you. I don't think you're making excuses. And I'm so glad to hear you say that, we need to be kind and gentle with ourselves, because there's aspects of this that are so challenging. But you said something that was really key, Debbie, that we need to be human beings. And that's exactly what the Buddha meant when he said, I'm teaching a middle way between extreme views, meaning teaching something that can't be applied in a normal human life. This isn't about escaping our humanness. It's about becoming fully human. And how else can you do that except by allowing yourself to be human? You know, to have your fears and your frustrations and your resistance, and recognizing all of that is merely impermanent views. But we have to work with what we have, you know, with what we have. We can't go past that. We can't force ourselves to get dependent origination the first time I read it or anything else. We have to allow ourselves to be human beings. And that's exactly what the Buddha taught. He taught a path for human beings to develop. We don't need to be superhuman beings. And if we're going to be human beings, we need to be gentle with ourselves. And it's amazing how the more gentle we are with ourselves, the more gentle we are with other people. In fact, that's a good way of knowing how gentle we are with ourselves, is if we're being rough with other people, we're probably being pretty rough on ourselves too. Thank you so much for saying that. Jen.
I'm practicing so much restraint today because I could talk about this all day. But I just want to say that, well, no, it's not true. I won't say a lot of things, but I just will say, I think I've only been able to observe this dependent origination process within myself very, like, fleetingly. So I do think initially it is helpful to just, rather than understand dependent origination, try to observe it in yourself.
Yep.
Observe how when something happens outside of you and it comes in and you take it in, you have a reaction to it. And that reaction is your ego arising.
Yep.
And you can observe that, and you can observe how subtle things come through and you react. And subtle things come through and you react. Just watch that. Just watch. Just observe. That's all.
Thank you. I was talking to an online student, Ernest. Hi, Ernest, if you watch this. And he was talking about how he catches his ego meditating with him. isn't that a perfect explanation when you're caught up in your thoughts? You know, my ego's meditating now. Well, okay, so dependent origination is an important concept, but it shouldn't be looked at as the path. It's something that we develop over time. And the fact that we don't fully comprehend it is not going to hold us back from developing the Eightfold Path. But it's important to understand it and to see it in context. So it's gotten a little bit late. I hope nobody has to leave. It's 10:02, by the way. But I'll just introduce the five clinging aggregates briefly. And then give me a second to find my spot. Sorry about that. I had it all set up just how I wanted it, but I lost it. So the Buddha is using the concept of the five clinging aggregates to show the insubstantial and impermanent nature of what is perceived as an individual. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications or assumptions, and the resulting consciousness. And the calling them clinging aggregates refers to the fact that we cling these discrete components together, and together we use them to define a permanent self. In other words, because I have a form that has feelings, that creates perceptions, that creates assumptions, and that has an ongoing consciousness. Now remember that consciousness is rooted in ignorance. But because of these five things, this proves that there's a self here, a permanent self. Much like that famous phrase, I think, therefore I am. Just the fact that I have a self-referential thought proves of my permanent existence. Of course, what the Buddha realized is that there's no such thing as a permanent existence, that everything, including what we see as a self, is in a constant state of becoming, which points to that important question, what am I going to become? That's up to us. The Buddha's words, the five aggregates are anicca, impermanent. Whatever is impermanent, that is suffering, that is dukkha, that is unsatisfactory. Whatever is dukkha, that is without a self. So the Buddha's speaking directly to the fact that if there's any suffering involved there, there can't be a self. A true self is not prone to suffering, not prone to confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experience. So, and Lorna mentioned this just a few moments ago. Anytime you find yourself caught up in a stressful, reactionary state of mind, it's always appropriate to say, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And you can immediately stop that ongoing process of, oh, what's happening to me? Boy, am I in trouble. Isn't this awful? This is not me, this is not mine. And that will allow you to see the temporary situation unfolding. It's just part of life. Whatever is dukkha, that is without a self. What is without self, that is not mine, that I am not, that is not myself. Thus should it be seen by perfect wisdom, as opposed to ignorance. Thus should it be seen by perfect wisdom as it really is. Who sees by perfect wisdom as it really is, his mind not grasping, is detached from fabrications. He is liberated. So when you see yourself as you really are, you still have a form. And you still have feelings. Those feelings give rise to perceptions, and those perceptions, even in an awakened state, will give rise to a certain type of assumption, but an assumption rooted more in wisdom than in ignorance. And that will give rise to an ongoing consciousness. But you're no longer using that sensory experience to define yourself as a fixed, permanent self. You simply realize that those are just components that you're using to have a human experience, but you're not using them to define a self. That's almost as obscure, I think, as saying as dependent origination. But again, it's only something that you can understand by having the experience of it. But first, you have to have the framework to understand. Yeah, I see that now. I see form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness that I used to use to describe myself is now simply a process of becoming. So as an awakened human being, or someone inclined towards awakening, we're still in that same mass of aggregates, but now we're not clinging to anything. So at any point, a feeling, rather than reinforcing the five clinging aggregates, is now fodder for awakening. We can use that because we understand its proper place. We're no longer clinging. So another simple explanation of five clinging aggregates is just clinging to ignorant views. That's what results in these five clinging aggregates. And that's really the way the Buddha used these. It's another concept that's wildly misinterpreted and it's made very complicated. There's some later developed teachings that get into elaborate explanations of what a form is. A form is just a form. And where feelings come from, in fact, I was reading something years ago, but I still remember it, about feelings being stuck in this multi-dimensional causative thing. And I, wow, man, they're just feelings. They happen because we're human beings. But stop identifying. Another way of saying stop identifying with feeling is when we insist that we feel different than we are in this moment, that's identifying with a feeling, and that's creating an identity over that feeling. I need to feel different, rather than just this is what's occurring right now. I might be feeling sad. I might even be feeling angry. When I was married, I was a much angrier person back then when I was younger, when I was married, and I was still in the habit of telling other drivers how unhappy I was with their performance. And I used to do it in a very vehement way. And I used to get my future ex-wife very upset. And she was there. It wasn't a pleasant experience. But she'd always say, how can you be so upset one minute and okay the next? I says, well, I just got it out of my system. And at least I had a way of not carrying it around. In other words, once that poor, unfortunate soul was out of my sight, I'd let it go too. But all of those states are temporary. Hopefully we don't get too angry like that anymore when we're developing the Dhamma. But to recognize that every state that we find ourselves in is an impermanent state and there's no reason to create an identity over it. I'm not angry. You know, I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm not scared. I might be in fear at this moment. I might be concerned about where the country's going, you know, to pick a topical thing. It's all temporary. As Lao Tzu said, once you recognize the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. And as that applies to the Dhamma, once you recognize the impermanence of your own views, you'll let go of the views. You'll realize they only create stress for you. That's enough on this. So next week we'll talk about this in more detail, the five clinging aggregates. And then we're getting into the three marks of existence next week. I'll introduce that. And that, again, ties into all of this in a very nice way. So any questions about this, the five clinging aggregates?
We should just stay on week eight. We're still on week eight, right?
Yeah. I split week eight up into two parts because it really is... There's probably enough to go 4 weeks on it, but we'll split it up into two. And now, one thing I wanted to point out, the talks from the last year's retreat are on the website, and I think it's five, six, and seven that are on what we're at right now. So if you got 3 or 4 hours to listen to all three of them, you'll find them helpful because they're in the context, and we're going to do it again this year. So, all right, no questions? Let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta then. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path, and an expression of a fully awake and fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.